Welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast series by Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I'm Giuseppe Porcaro, and this is a summer feature of The Sound of Economics recorded on the road as part of the Reopening Europe project. We traveled more than 2,700 kilometers through the Netherlands, Germany, France, Austria, Slovenia, and Italy to collect voices from the ground between the 12th and the 27th of June, during the weeks when the borders were reopening after the COVID-19 lockdown.
And at one moment they closed off the borders.
Even the one with the salary, they lost the job.
Had to close the restaurant, so it was a little bit stressful.
Nous avons pu travailler avec les partenaires des différents pays.
Afgelopen woensdag kreeg ik een berichtje van de wethouder.
Finalmente hanno riaperto i confini.
In this episode, you will be listening to a conversation I had with Michael Lee in Florence on the 23rd of June. Michael is a Bruegel Senior Fellow and also Academic Director of the Masters in European Public Policy at the Johns Hopkins University in Bologna. Michael asked me to tell more about the project and what I've learned on the way. He told me about his experience locally in Bologna and in Italy, and we discussed the impact of the pandemic on multiscalar governance and the future of Europe. We jumped into the car with three people, me and two other people, Andre and David. We are like a team of crazy fellows to a certain extent that decided to go when Europe was reopening. Well, each member state, to be precise, were reopening the different borders after the COVID-19 first wave of pandemic, and trying to get a temperature check, of the economics, of the politics, and of the society, but not at a national level, not at the macroeconomic level, but really trying to give some voice to the territories, the local places, and above all, also the border kind of regions.
Well, your experience really fits in with the overall pattern where the EU has a certain role to play, but the most important decisions during COVID-19 have been taken at a national, regional, local, and in some cases, even cross-border level. So this is like a new experiment in a way with multi-level governance.
Indeed, and this was one of the things that we observed during the way, this multi-level governance that at first sight is not so visible. At the local level, you start to see it. For example, I give you an example. We were in Strasbourg and they have Kiel, which is just across the bridge of the Rhine. And a lot of the actual medical emergency, they have a lot of people that are cross-bordering every, there's 70,000 people crossing the bridge every day on one way or another. So the medical emergency was a very local emergency. But all of a sudden they were like divided by the border. So there was a practical issue, but also there was a medical issue because the French side was more burdened because it was one of the red zones in France, were more burdened. And it was at the local level that the transfer of patients from, Alsace to other places in Germany took place because of the special situation of this cross-border region.
I mean, this is a big part of what's happened with COVID-19 because at the beginning, the story was that the EU couldn't get its act together, and even that the Chinese and the Russians and the Albanians were doing more than the European countries were to help Italy and other European countries in serious trouble. But meanwhile, this kind of support built up, and best practice being exchanged, and actually patients being taken from one country to be treated in another. And I don't think that part of the narrative has really got out. So your project can perhaps really help to familiarize people with the reality of what's taken place over the last few weeks.
Indeed, and this is a little bit what we are trying to observe, even if it's not all the time very easy to grasp it. But it seems to me just the tip of an iceberg of a different way of actually conceptualizing the European governance within the frame of what we have at the moment, not outside the frame of what we have at the moment. That's the incredible thing about it. You know, it's not about challenging the model or the treaties or whatever. It's about how do we find new creative ways of working together.
Yes, and also for people to understand that this forms part of the bigger European picture, because we don't hear much about it. These are modest initiatives that work well, and no one is trying to develop the narrative publicly. They're just getting on with it. So I think you're doing a very useful service in bringing that to people's attention.
Well, you are in Bologna specifically, so you've been living through the whole COVID-19 crisis in a specific place, which is the city of Bologna, in a specific region, which is Emilia-Romagna, but in a specific member state of the EU, which is Italy. So this already could feel a Netflix series of three or four seasons on the political at the political level in terms of political science, but also when it comes to the impact on the economy and broadly speaking. What has been your first-hand experience of living this this thing in that specific place?
It's full of contradictions. At the very beginning, for example, those of us who were living and working in Bologna and were in lockdown, we had no particular difficulties. Bologna is a city with a great deal of civic pride, good structure, good organization, and people respect the rules that have been laid down. So for us personally, I can't say that we faced any very serious problems. But about less than a kilometer from where I'm living, there's the large public hospital in Bologna that is servicing the wider region within Emilia-Romagna. And the thought that less than a kilometer from where we were living decent lives in lockdown, there were initially scenes which were almost medieval, with the intensive care units being overwhelmed, the medical profession being overwhelmed, doctors falling ill. So one felt this very deeply.
And now that we are towards the reopening of this, after this first wave, what is your feeling within the specific frame that you had to have, and how do you think this reopening itself is molding something different or not? What have you been seeing going on in Italy, especially?
Well, it's also a mixed picture. On the one side, people are very respectful of social distancing and the rules that have been set down. And there's also been a surprising degree of clarity about what people should and should not do. Outside of Italy, people don't always appreciate the capacity, particularly at the local level, to communicate clearly with the population. In the buses, it's crystal clear where you should sit, where you shouldn't sit, on the trains. So in terms of social distancing, the picture in principle is very clear, but in practice, there is such a sense of relief that at last the parks are open, the cafes, the bars, the restaurants are open, and Bologna is just about an hour's drive to the beach. So at the weekend, there has been a rush to go to the sea. And even though the people who run the different beach facilities that are there are in principle also respecting the rules, the fact of the matter is that people are so relieved that they have forgotten almost completely about this. And again, at the anecdotal level, it certainly looks that younger people who have the feeling anyway that they're not particularly at risk are completely back to the old practices. And on a Friday night, on a Saturday night, the center of the city is full of young people chatting, walking, drinking, listening to music, as if nothing had ever happened. So I think that there is a certain cause for concern that the euphoria of the lockdown being over is not leading people to some brave new world, but rather back to where we were before, if anything, even in an exaggerated way because of the sense of relief.
I understand that, but if we want to draw some lessons on what has been happened so far, do you think that beside the immediate part of what you say, this relief, this euphoria that we are witnessing also in our trip, we've been witnessing a lot of this euphoria, people finally on the street and so on. If you would look a little bit in the medium term, is there something that will be taken from these months of lockdown that would change the way we are doing business in the city, or the way politics at national and local level, like the interaction between the different territorial levels, are happening, including the European one? What kind of those kind of lessons we can draw from your perspective as a political scientist?
Well, looking at the big picture, I think one can say that the key decisions have been taken at local and regional level, not at national level and not at the EU level. And I think that the principle that the EU should only establish rules where it can be done better at the European level than at the national or local level has been confirmed again. You know, at an early stage when it looked as though we were going to move away from the strict rules towards recovery and towards a gradual relaxation, the Commission issued, the European Commission, a roadmap that countries were expected to follow, setting out the principles for little by little relaxing the rules. And some Brussels observers said, not very kindly, that this is neither a road nor a map. But the fact is, even if it had been, the situation is so different within each country and in each locality that de facto, anyway, the rules are being established at a much more local level. So if anything, this reinforces the principle that the EU should become involved where there's genuine European added value and should leave it to the national, regional, local level when there's no obvious European component.
So to a certain extent, this is the confirmation that the principle of subsidiarity is like a centerpiece of the European construction. But on the other hand, we've been seeing that what you just said about the intervention of the local authorities, either regional or city level, has been quite important. Isn't it also showing something about the fact that the national level itself has its own challenges or limitations, or like, is there anything that can be rethought? Not so much at the European level, because there is already this flexibility. The subsidiarity principle, to a certain extent, if I may say, it's already flexible enough to say, if something is need to be dealt at European level, because that's the level that needs to be dealt, we should deal it at the European level. But if situation change, this subject is subject matter of national, local, or whatever it is, we have a principle there. It is enshrined. I'm not sure, I mean, this very personal take, I'm not sure that at national level we have such same level of flexibility.
No, and I think the big factor that distinguishes the approach of different national authorities and different member states during COVID-19 has been communications and the clarity of communications. And this is a lesson, I think, to be learned from all of this. And there are many ironies that go against stereotypes of national character. Mm-hmm. For example, as we say in Brussels, slightly turned around, the country that I used to know best, the United Kingdom, has had a bad epidemic. First of all, because of a lack of clarity at the beginning and again at the end as to the strategy adopted, but also, and in particular, a lack of clarity in communicating this to the population. And if there is one big complaint in the UK, it is a failure to understand, a lack of clarity in communication. Ironically, I would say, in Italy, which has so many political challenges, this problem didn't really arise. And the decisions taken at the national level were of a kind of clarity one could almost not imagine. And in fact, I shared some of these decrees with people in parts of the English speaking world who were responsible in their own countries for drawing up these regulations, because there was a surprising degree of clarity at the national level. So no one is complaining in Italy that we didn't know what we should do and what we shouldn't do. There may be complaints about implementation and enforcement, but in fact, there were more than 1 million fines issued in Italy for people who had violated social distancing rules. So, strangely enough, I think Italy did fairly well at the national level when it came to communications. But the actual action itself had to be taken more at the regional and local level, and there it's a very mixed picture.
If you would have a time machine and we would be 20 years from now, how do you think that this whole crisis would not be remembered? Because we are not speaking about the past, but how do you think that all these kind of lessons that we are seeing at the moment would be taken over in a way that things would change, and what kind of changes that those would be? I mean, and this is like not a prediction that I'm asking. It's more like a wish, you know, like more if you would be able to design how those things could potentially change things.
Well, if it were a wish,
yes,
then I think, you know, the wish could be summed up with the word, which is a bit of a cliche, sustainability. Because what we've seen in Italy during these past weeks would have been unimaginable previously in Venice, which you visited, and I'm sure you also have impressions that would be interesting to hear. But in Venice, mass tourism simply stopped. And the damage that was being done to buildings, to the canals, which didn't come only from cruise ships, but even just from the amount of traffic, water taxes, and so on, creating disturbances, has been spectacular. And, you know, fish have returned to the canals, jellyfish and others have been seen that haven't been seen for decades, if not longer. And mass tourism has stopped. And we've begun to see in the relaxation period something like a rather gentle movement towards quality tourism. So if one had a wish, it would be that this kind of sustainable tourism, tourism is so important in Italy, 12, 13% of GDP, could be the wave of the future. In northern Italy, when anybody has traveled to Milan or traveled to Bologna by air, as soon as you fly over the Alps and you get the message coming across that you should fasten your safety belts and we're about to land, you look out of the window and you see this murky haze in the air. And satellite photos of northern Italy have always shown a high degree of air pollution over northern Italy. Satellite photos for the last 3 months have showed crystal clarity over northern Italy. So if I had a wish, it would be that somehow or other restrictions could be put in place. People would choose to travel by train and not by air. I understand in France, for example, that airlines are only being authorized on routes over 2 hours, because within 2 hours, people could take the train. The train needs to be, have to look at the cost basis for that. Fares in France are very high. But in Italy, rail fares are very democratic. So a wish would be that rather than having a very dense network of air traffic over northern Italy, more people would use the very efficient and not at all costly network of high-speed trains, and that we could move towards a higher degree of sustainability. but you asked for wishes. This is not a question of how you get from where we are today to where we would wish to be in the future.
Thank you. Do you have some questions for me?
Well, you've had such an ambitious project, which has been crammed into such a short space of time. I'm sure this has given you an opportunity to form a comparative idea of the way in which Belgium, the Netherlands, Germany, Italy, Slovenia have been coping. So what would interest me is your broad appreciation of the way the different countries that you visited on this project have responded to the challenge.
Well, I think that in our exploration of different borders and different states, we have seen a lot of different moods going around. And what has been very interesting is the time frame that we chose to go and explore those borders. The time frame was starting on the 12th of June, a few days between from when the border between Belgium and the Netherlands and Belgium and Germany were opened. The border between Netherlands and Germany was never closed, apparently. So it was an interesting time by having lived in Belgium, like living in Belgium, to go out of the country, because that was just the beginning of being able to do it and still restricted to certain countries. And the way we experienced it was very much linked to the time frame, because while going to the Netherlands and then Germany and then Luxembourg and then France and then Germany again and then Austria and Slovenia, we lived through the moments where those borders were being reopened. So, for example, we arrived in the Netherlands the day that the only boat service between two sides of the Maas River in a small village on the sides of the Netherlands and another small village on the side of Belgium resumed service. So we could really see what was this kind of euphoria that we've been mentioning about, this kind of euphoria of the reopening of the borders was there. And at each time that we've been traveling, we kind of caught this euphoria. So somehow, because we were coming from a situation in Belgium which was still kind of closed, it was shocking for us. It was really like we were traveling from another era. It was not just about traveling on different places, but on different times. And that was what made our road somehow very experimental, very close to, I don't know what, very rarely you could leave these kind of things in the current globalized, set aside European Union setting. So we really lived this. And all the time we were going somewhere, there was a step up in the level of the opening, you know. So when we arrived in Germany, we saw that people didn't wear masks outside, but they were wearing masks inside. When we arrived in Salzburg in Austria, everyone was in the park, like having a stroll, and it was like totally inconceivable for us, you know. No one was wearing a mask, and it was like totally different. Then, you know, the more we went on, the more we tried to understand, you know, how this was combined with the local regulations and so on. So it was for us quite a shock. I still believe that we are coming from this beginning. So we are coming still from that situation, which was pretty, not entirely a lockdown situation, but pretty strict situation. So it's still very hard for us, since we are in the middle of our journey, to really completely unpack those feelings.
And did you feel that there were certain countries that were approaching the relaxation after the lockdown in a more or less disciplined fashion? Were there, and if so, did that correspond with previous national stereotypes, or were these national stereotypes blown out of the water by what you experienced? But
We had quite an interesting experience related to the stereotypes of the countries we were visiting and the way the measures were implemented when it came to the reopening. So, for instance, we were quite surprised of going in Austria, which in our mind was pretty strict when it came to border control, and seeing that the situation was completely different from Germany, where there was a relaxation, but there was still quite a strict application of certain rules when it came to sanitizing, using the mask, the way you were entering in a restaurant, and all these kind of things. When we went to Austria, it simply seemed that COVID-19 was never happened in Austria, you know. But on the other hand, we were quite afraid about the border trespassing because we heard that they were quite strict in terms of border control, which didn't happen. So, for instance, we were surprised again when we went to Slovenia, which had a very, very low rate as well. But the border between Austria and Slovenia was the only border where they asked us for papers. So we were surprised once again about the stereotypes versus what we found on the way. And last but not least, I personally thought to find a situation which was larger, stricter than what we found when we arrived in Venice. I expected a situation where the masks were worn all the time, where people were very strict, and I was very surprised that people at some point were shaking hands.
And did you get the feeling that for the people you spoke to, things were going to change after COVID-19? Or did you get a sense of things going back to the familiar ways of doing business?
I think that there has been two ways of experiencing this. There was one way, which was the willingness to be back to a normal life. I mean, this was a shared feeling everywhere we went. But on the other hand, there has been in several circumstances reflections about how that specific kind of crisis could lead to a certain change in the way either the relation between the local government and the national government or in the way people are interacting. So there have been a certain reflection still because it was still fresh. So that's something that was exactly our intention, to trying to see this before it's going to fade completely. It's like a very, very, you know, it's like a moment where you have something, you make something on the sand that still is very, you know, it was very impressive. And then, you know, the sea is fading it out, but very slowly. And we can still see a little bit of this. And that's a very interesting part of that project. You know, if we manage to get at least a little tiny bit of this moment impressed and you know, snapshotted, photographed, that would be a good way for a success for our journey.
And did you get any spontaneous expressions of opinion about European solidarity, about whether either in the wide sense of the European Union coming up with solutions, with proposals, with initiatives that could really help people's lives, or in a more immediate, down-to-earth sense of solidarity from neighboring countries, from other European peoples? Is this a subject that came up spontaneously in your conversations?
The subject of European solidarity came more prominent in the border regions because they experience cross-border solidarity, or they experienced cross-border solidarity on a daily level. And therefore, they were able to translate what they have been their life experience, especially the specific complicated life experience that they had to go through during the COVID-19 first wave, and translate that also to a European reflection. Especially in Strasbourg and in Kiel, this was quite prominent in those places. It was pretty clear that they made even, I have to say, I don't know if exaggerating or not, but they kind of say the experience that we lived in this region, in this specific place, has been the reason why at some point Berlin and Paris had to speak together and had to find some solution for European solidarity. And I believe that there is a certain truth about that.
Right. I think we covered a lot of territory, no?
Thank you very much, Michael.
Thank you. It was a pleasure. Thanks very much.
And this brings us to the end of this episode, which was part of the Reopening Europe summer feature of The Sound of Economics. I would like to remind you that you can find more podcasts, video and information about our road trip on the website www.reopeningeurope.com. On the 2nd of September, during Bruegel annual meetings, we will launch a documentary from Reopening Europe. You can keep up to date with the launch and the program of the annual meetings on www.bam.bruegel.org. Thank you for tuning in to The Sound of Economics. Until next time, bye-bye.